Proverbs chapter 24, please. Proverbs chapter 24. And we'll read at verse 30. I went by the field of the slothful and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding, void of heart. And lo, it was all grown over with thorns, and nettles had covered the face thereof, and the stone wall thereof was broken down. Then I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. Now, one more reading, please, in the last chapter of this book. Proverbs 31 and verse 10. The world talks about men finding a trophy wife that they can put on display at social functions. Possible to get the trophy and miss the treasure that is spoken about in this chapter. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hand. She is like the merchant ships, she bringeth her food from afar. She riseth also while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hand she planteth a vineyard. So you'll notice that she has a field and a vineyard as well. She girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Verse 20. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor, yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. Notice verse 24. She maketh fine linen and selleth it, and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hand, and let her own works praise her in the gate. Sometimes I've stayed in homes where the room I'm using, the host and hostess have placed cameos, perhaps small pictures in a delightful little frame, pictures of grandchildren or relatives, people that are loved very much. And in some ways, the few passages we have read are cameos. They are small pictures, but they are character cameos. We are allowed to see, first of all, the field of the slothful servant, what he is like and what he produces, and then the family of the virtuous woman and what she is like and what the results are in that home. I want them to just notice these two characters with you in the hopes that our hearts will be stirred to be more like that virtuous woman than this slothful servant. Notice, please, the character of the man, as we are told in this chapter. He is called a slothful man. That is, he is indolent, he is lazy, he is slack in his approach to things. The word actually comes from a root word that means to lean. To lean. If you've ever, you wouldn't have this in Canada, but if you're ever driving through the States and you come across the interminable construction zones where they always seem to be shifting barrels and working, there's generally the picture of a man with his shovel upright, and one foot is raised on the top of the blade of the shovel, and then his arms are folded over the handle of the shovel, and he's leaning. And of course there's the sign, your highway tax is at work, and it's good something is working because he's leaning. Now that's the picture here. He is leaning instead of laboring. There's some delightful little tree in that field that's in the shade, and the sun's awful hot, it's worse than in the tent. And so he's there just in a hot afternoon. It doesn't matter that there's thorns in the vineyard. It doesn't matter that things are breaking down, the world's falling apart. He's got his back against that tree, and he's leaning as the
Not all the things are breaking down, the world's falling apart. He's got his back against that tree, and he's leaning as the afternoon passes. Well, that's the picture we have. And the book of Proverbs has a lot to say about the slothful man. You will remember that it says that the slothful man roasteth not that which he took in hunting. That is, he never derives the full benefit from things. Things that were won at great cost are not precious to him. And we can be like that in the things of God. I was born in a home where I had truth handed to me on a silver platter. And when I was saved, this is a great encouragement to me trying to raise children. I don't remember hardly one thing I ever learned as a sinner listening to ministry. Not one. I can't remember a message. I can't remember one finely made, well-tailored point that the preacher had honed over hours of study. Don't remember anything about that. But the moment that I was saved, I had some concept of what Christian living meant, of what was expected by God from a person who believes in His Son. I picked that up. And I had no trouble working my way through all the darkness of denominationalism and finally finding a place where God had put the name of His Son. That was all just handed to me. And it is possible to be slothful with God's truth and things that were won at great cost to others and were freely handed to me, but I will be slothful with them and never derive the full benefit from them. You remember that it says about the slothful man that he is brother to him that is a great waster. That it is possible to be slothful with gift and ability that God has given to you. And that God would have to see a life that he intended for greatness in the things of God being wasted. And ability that was intended to be employed for God and for God's people being frittered away in wasteful, slothful lack of exercise. The man who's slothful is brother to him that is a great waster. And what a great waste it is when God has gifted some sister for something for him, some brother for some service for God. And that gift never developed. That life never yielded. That purpose never realized. That consecration never enforced in a life that ought to be yielded to God. We read about the slothful man that he says there's a lion without. A lion is in the street. Now, I'm sure that there was a lion somewhere outside the man's door, but the idea is that he's easily deterred. This is just an excuse. Instead of getting busy about what he's supposed to be doing, he says, well, you know, there's danger to that. There's a lion out there. If I go outside, I could be hurt. I think I better just stay in. And so a slothful person is easily deterred from his duty, from doing what God wants him to do. There's the slothful man. Now, the other thing about this man is that he's void of heart. Void of understanding, is actually lacking in heart, lacking in drive, lacking in ambition, lacking in full-hearted interest. Have we lost heart? We lost our heart for the things of God. You remember that it says about Daniel that he purposed in his heart that he should not defile himself? We need to have a heart in our separation, not just keeping apart from the world because that's what we're supposed to do, but having our heart in it. You remember that it says about Barnabas that he exhorted them all that with purpose of heart they should cleave to the Lord. And of course we need heart in our devotion, not just moving through Christian life, doing things in a perfunctory fashion, just whatever we have to do, we do it, but having heart in it, devoted to the Lord. You will recall that David said he had prepared with all his heart for the house of his God. Who then, in light of that, who then is willing to consecrate his service this day to the Lord? We need heart in our consecration as well. To be Daniel-like, to be David-like, to be Barnabas-like. I remember reading a couple of years ago, now don't get hung up on this story, because if you begin to think about it, it was a bit gruesome and also a bit amusing, but funeral directors were summoned to a nursing home to remove the body and prepare for burial, and they were told what the room was, and they went into the room, and they came to the bed, and they saw the body, and so I don't know if you've ever been in a room and they leaving the body. I was there when they took away the previous body, and they don't handle it all that gently. They removed the body, carted her away to be prepared for burial, drove her to the funeral home, wheeled her into the back room, began to work on the corpse, and found that they had brought the wrong person. So bundled her up, wheeled her back out, carted her back to the nursing home, wheeled her back into her room, gently laid the dear old soul back to where she was, and went over to the other bed and got the corpse. Of course, the problem was there was so little left of movement in this one that they couldn't tell the difference. And sometimes, dear brethren, let's face it, there is so little left, so little heart in our meeting, in our service, in our devotion, in our consecration.
The funeral director would have trouble telling which is the corpse and which is the living person. That man's void of heart. He's got no interest in what he's supposed to be doing. He's just there. He's void of heart.
Notice the condition of the field. When you bear in mind that this has an application to God's assembly, that an assembly of God is God's tilled field. When you bear in mind that Solomon recorded the words of one who could say, they made me keeper of the vineyard, but my own vineyard have I not kept. When we bring to bear on the passage the idea that this can represent what can happen to an assembly through slothfulness and slackness, and what can happen to an individual believer's life through that same kind of lack of exercise, then it is exceedingly solemn to think of the condition of the field. The first thing is it was overgrown. Things had been allowed to take their natural course. He hadn't been working away at that field to keep the thorns out, to keep the thing from being overgrown. You are as likely to naturally develop for God as your garden will naturally develop lilacs and roses. You are as likely to naturally develop utility, usefulness in the service of God, to naturally develop that. The field will naturally develop corn, wheat, rye, bark. This man had not been busy about what he should be doing. Is it like that, you know? Have we just kind of pressed the cruise control and after the early exercise of young Christian days, we're just kind of cruising now? Kind of as if we have plateaued out. We've reached it now, and from here on in, we'll just ride on the path. And of course, that becomes very, very sober when we begin to think about gospel work. What a terrible thing it would be if the preachers who came here, after all your work and labor and expense, had Samson's attitude. And just thought to themselves, it'll just be like other times. They'll just shake ourselves and get up and preach, and God will be with us. What a terrible thing that would be. What a terrible thing it would be if any of us had that attitude and failed to realize that we cannot allow things to take their natural course. That's one lesson I learned from Jabez. Because when he was born, his mother hanged a name on him that seemed to be ominous. She called him sorrowful. Whether there was something about his birth, whatever was related to the early days of that boy, the name that was given to him seemed to bode ill. That this life would be a life of sorrow, of misfortune. Do you remember what happened? Jabez set himself to seek God. And he prayed that God would keep him from the sorrow that it may not be grievous to him. And the prayers of that man Jabez turned the natural course of his life. God responded. And it could be that exercise before God could turn what would be the natural course of these meetings, barren, into fruitfulness, as God responded to Elijah like praying. It was not only overgrown, but it was covered. It was no longer recognizable. It had lost its character, its distinction. Had you walked by the man's field and looked over the remnants of that broken wall, you'd hardly have known what the difference was between the wild forest and fields and what was intended to be a fertile vineyard. He had allowed it to become overgrown and covered. Lost its character. He lost our character. Have you allowed your life to lose its distinctive quality as a child of God? Is there not something terribly solemn and searching when Paul has this criticism to level against the Corinthians? You are men. And you're walking as men walk. He says you've come down to the level of just living ordinary lives. You're just living like the people around you. He doesn't say that they become ungodly. He's not saying to them that they're worse than sinners. He says you are just living normal, average, routine, vanilla-flavored lives. You have lost the distinction of your link with the Son of God.
what happened to the field. Campbell Morgan used to tell about a gentleman who came up to him after a meeting, and he said to him, "Mr. Morgan," he said, "you won't believe this." He said, "I worked beside a man for 5 years. 5 years. And he said, "Did you know neither of us knew we were Christians?" He said, "Just this week." He said, he looked at me, I think the man had said something or just dropped a hint of something that was linked with the Bible. And the man turned to him and said, "Oh, do you know the Bible?" And so he said, "I told him, yes, I'm saved. Do you read the Bible?" He said, "Yes, I'm saved too." He said, "Isn't it funny, Mr. Morgan, 5 years and neither of us knew we were Christians?" Morgan said, "Funny? Absolutely tragic. Tragic. To have worked alongside of a human being and never have given him the gospel? Not one glimmer of possibility that this person is different? To have a life that's covered, lost its quality, exposed. The field is exposed because the wall has been broken down. Separation has been lost. Is that true in your life, dear sister, dear brother? Lost the separation, the wall is broken down, the world has come in, it's robbed you of your character and distinctive quality as a believer. And where once the wall was up and you inspected it and made sure it was all right and the evil was kept on the other side and the world was not allowed in, now the world is broken down and it's come in. Time to repair the wall, dear child of God. Time to repair the wall. Because there will always be loss if we allow the wall to be broken. Always. You remember in Numbers chapter 25, it was the loss of a future leader. How careful Moses is to point out that when Israel let the wall down and the master of opening, through Balaam's craft, came flooding in with that unequal yoke, how careful the writer is to record the man who died with the prince. What that man could have been, what the future held for that man, what usefulness he could have been for God, all that ended when the javelin of Phinehas drowned in the midst of his sin. The loss of a future leader. When you come to the book of Nehemiah, you find that it brought the loss of a past heritage. You recall that most unusual expression that the people who had intermarried with the people of the land, that they spoke half in the language of Ashdod. Now finish the verse. If you were writing it, what would you think the last half of that verse would be? They spoke half in the language of Ashdod, and I think I would have put, I suppose, half in the language of Israel. But that's not what it says. It says that these people spoke half in the language of Ashdod and could not speak the Jews' language. They had lost something. A heritage had slipped away from them. It wasn't just the world's intent to share half and half with their past heritage, to allow them part for God and part for the world, but like some kind of fungus that had overgrown and had robbed the ability of these people to speak God's language. That's what the world would do if we allow the wall to be broken down. But I want you to notice very quickly the conclusion of the sage. Because he tells us at the end that a little laziness will bring up powerful poverty. Notice that he says a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. You'll recall that the wise man wrote about three little things. Because he wrote about the little flies in the book of Ecclesiastes. The little flies that spoil the ointment. And in the Song of Songs he wrote about the little foxes. And now he's writing about the little folding of the hands to sleep. Just little things. The small things that we would be likely to pass over. But those little things can rob our joy, can rob our worship, can rob our growth and fruitfulness. And so the exhortation to us is to cover the ointment. Keep the flies out. To keep the vineyard. Don't let the foxes in. To cultivate the field. Make sure that your growth and fruitfulness for God is maintained. Don't become slothful. For the poverty will come with tremendous force and power, like a traveler, inexorably. Day after day after day, the traveler's on the road making his way toward his destination. That's how inexorable this poverty will come on you. Like a warrior, irresistibly. Not turned aside by our futile efforts to somehow postpone the poverty. It will come with overwhelming power on us if we are like this slothful man. But in just a few minutes left to me, I want to notice with you the family of this virtuous woman. I think there is first of all a lesson in priorities. Let me just grab two
phrases from the passage. The first is the heart of her husband, and the second is the ways of her household. Now in that first expression, the heart of her husband, we are reminded of the one to flee. The heart of her husband that safely trusts in her. That is like, that is reminiscent of Enoch, who before his translation had this testimony that he pleased God. That we must have before us this. Here's the priority. There is one to be pleased in our lives. Whether present or absent, said Paul, we are ambitious to be well-pleasing to him. To win the favor of the Son of God. To be well-pleasing to him. There's a day when Boaz came down to his field and he looked out over the reapers, the workers, and he spotted Ruth. She caught his eye. Have you ever caught the eye of the Son of God? Did you ever look down and saw you? Saw your anxious eyes? Saw your anxious to please him? And as he looked over his people, you caught his eye? Here's the one to please. The heart of her husband does safely trust in her. Here are the ones to protect. The ways of her household, they are well clothed, they are well fed. There's a cold world outside those doors. And yet they're laughing at the cold. That's the expression, I like the way the Septuagint version puts it. She shall rejoice even in the last days, no matter how difficult things are out there in the world, that it's possible to be so supported by God, so insulated against that world's coldness, so nourished by the warmth of this book, that we can rejoice even in the last days. That's Noah-like, isn't it? His whole life is devoted to this, the way of his household, to see those children in the ark safe. Now very quickly, notice please a lesson in activity. Because if I fail to impress upon you this part, then there is no link with what has gone before in Mr. Oliver's ministry. There are two expressions here again. It says that she spreads out her hand, or actually her palm, to the poor, and she reaches forth her hand to the needy. Now let me suggest to you that there are two activities there. Because in the idea of reaching out or stretching out the palm, seems to me that there's the idea there's something in her hand. There's something in her hand as she's stretching it out to the poor. They have a need. She's meeting that need. There's something in her hand to meet that need. And however affluent 20th century living may be on the West Coast, all around us in Vancouver just now, there are men and women that are savagely, brutally, eternally poor. Their poverty is overwhelming. And you think of the spiritual realm. And in your hand, dear believer, in your hand, something to meet that need. Now, will we withhold our hand, or will we stretch it out? You see, it's disturbing to me to realize how much I have allowed to slip the gospel spirit that marked believers before me. It was my privilege, along with Brother Oliver, and I'm not speaking for myself alone, but we both went out preaching the gospel about the same time, unknown to each other, our exercise unknown to each other. And I'm sure he's had this experience as well. I am sure that literally scores of times I've been able to hear older believers, particularly among the older Italians in New England, tell how they were saved. And invariably, there were not great meetings that came along and wonderful preachers that came to preach and special efforts underway. Almost to a man, they were saved because their Italian neighbor said to them, "I want you to come to a meeting Sunday night. I got salvation. I know I'm on the way to heaven. I have eternal life." And it was by word of mouth that the gospel was spread. Now let me speak to my generation here today. We fumbled the ball. Somehow. Some way. I couldn't pinpoint the year. I'm not intelligent enough to go back and tell you in what decade it happened. But somewhere back along in the last 20 or 25 years, there came a subtle shift away from personal evangelism to professional evangelism. Away from our doing daily the work of spreading the gospel, to the idea that, well, when special meetings come, we'll send the preacher. And I've had people tell me, "Mr. Higgins, you know, this person, I told him the gospel, but he said he never wants to hear it again. And the next person that says anything to him about this, he's going to shoot him. You mind going and seeing him? Maybe you could do something. And you laugh. But there have been things